This is Adam Chartoff, and you're listening to one of several special 2013 Sundance editions of Film Wax Radio. Straight from the icy trenches in Park City, Kristen McCracken is chatting up many of this festival's most talented filmmakers. In this, our last dispatch from Sundance, Kristen talks with filmmaking couple Tieck Lesson and Carl Diehl, who had a huge success back in 2008 with their documentary Trouble the Water. Carl and Tia are back, premiering their new documentary Citizen Coke, which explores the increasingly nefarious nature of political contributions and the increasing American distaste for where it's all going. Here's Kristen's conversation with Carl and Tia.
Hi, this is Kristen McCracken with Film Wax Radio on the ground in Park City for the Sundance Film Festival 2013. And I'm here talking with Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl, the co-directing team whose Citizen Coke premiered this week at the festival. Congratulations on your triumphant return after your 2008 Grand Jury Prize winning Trouble the Water. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Can you just tell us a little bit about the impetus for this film and how it got started, and maybe in that give a little preview about what it's about? It's a really nice blend, I thought, of the personal and the political, like big picture, little picture, and that really made it so layered and really rich.
Oh, well, Tia had to drag us into the little picture because I was obsessed with the big picture myself.
Happened about 4 years ago, around inauguration time. Carl became addicted to Glenn Beck. He was watching Glenn Beck almost 24/7, sinking deeper and deeper into that leather couch.
I still don't know what's wrong with that.
And it was actually like ruining our relationship. So our TiVo filled up, and I couldn't tape any of our TV shows. And we just decided, I said, "Look, you got if you want to keep taping him and watching this, let's do something with it."
Uh-huh.
You know, like so, let's you know. So we started out making a film about the vitriol, really, and how the right wing, both the conservative politicians and the media pundits, were attacking the Obama presidency just within days, really, of him assuming office. And we just didn't get it. We didn't understand it. It was so nasty, so vicious, and so coordinated. We wanted to understand what was happening, what was behind it. And then all of a sudden, the Tea Party emerged.
Mm-hmm.
And that drew us in. You know, who were these people, and why are they ostensibly organizing against, you know, working people organizing against some of their best interests and allying themselves with the wealthiest in our country? And that's how we came on the trail of the Koch brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's accurate.
So when did the Koch brothers kind of become apparent to you that they were a major player in this situation?
Well, you know, I mean, we'd been aware of the activities of the Koch brothers for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sort of, in a way, they're pioneers in deploying their millions or billions in very creative political ways, dating back to the late 70s and the 80s. And, you know, I was an investigative journalist and had, at one stage, did a lot of research looking at the right-wing organizations. We called them anti-environmental groups, you know, groups like the Cato Institute or Citizens for a Sound Economy, and groups that organize people as sort of astroturf groups to appear to be grassroots organizations, but to lobby for policy change that favored big corporations like Koch Industries. So they were kind of on our radar, but we'd forgotten all about them.
Okay.
And it wasn't until we started just scratching a little bit when we saw the rise of the Tea Party movement that, lo and behold, their names came up associated with a group called Americans for Prosperity, which was organizing a lot of these Tea Party meetings. And so that really caught our fancy. And then we got a tip that they were convening billionaires and right-wing pundits twice a year in fancy resorts to decide to fundraise and to decide how to spend that money to advance both their bottom line, but also their political ideology, which is extreme within the Republican Party.
As a matter of fact, after this, we just came back from a screening at the Egyptian Theater, and a well-dressed woman came up to me afterwards and said, "I was at that Koch brothers retreat that you show in your film."
Wow.
And she said, "What you think they were doing is exactly right."
Huh.
But they were looking at coordinating a state-by-state strategy to flip America.
Uh-huh.
This was not, they weren't so focused necessarily on the national races. They were looking at
the state by state
gubernatorial assemblies, you know, which, look, that's where our laws get written.
So how was this woman, she flipped her switch
she
a little
actually,
bit?
She
or
actually liked the film. She said she didn't contribute to Americans for Prosperity or to the Kochs fundraising effort, and she probably won't go back again.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought it was actually very fair-handed what we put on screen there.
So. Good. So you snuck into one of these? How did you get on the guest list? I mean, they kicked you out, but you got on the guest. How did you even get on the guest list?
Well,
don't tell them.
We could keep it a secret if you want.
The big question is, how did they spot me, and how, you know?
What changed?
I guess I am who I am, and. All the Gucci in the world and Hermes. I had a Hermes scarf on, but that didn't, you know, fool anybody.
Did they know who you were? Did they recognize you, or did they just,
I don't know? But I was forced to leave the hotel by Coke security. Not hotel security, but by Coke security. Hmm. Look, what they do, you know, because it's of such national import, you think, you know, the press could cover it, and
right.
That can't happen.
Right.
No, they have. In order to succeed, they have to do things in secret.
Right.
Because if people understood the extent to which they really are planning to maximize their power, just with dollars,
mm-hmm.
even at the ballot box,
mm-hmm.
people would be appalled.
And that's what we hope this film gives folks a glimpse, you know, behind closed doors.
Right.
We didn't get into that meeting. We got into some others that I think will stand your hair on end.
Mm-hmm.
What they discuss behind closed doors is actually what so many of us fear.
Well, I saw the parallel. I mean, I really thought about a lot the 47% comment and how we saw that. And I think that glimpse behind the curtain, behind the ugly kind of curtain, really turned the tide in the 2000s. Or, I mean, I don't know that Obama wouldn't have won otherwise, but that was such an important moment to expose that kind of just that kind of language that none of us had ever really heard, even though you may have speculated about it, but it wasn't
right.
So out there.
That's right. No.
But he forgot about the other 47% who rely on Big Bird to babysit.
Right.
He lost that vote, right?
That's right.
Both the public, I think, and the private comments did him in.
So just to explain the movie a little bit more, there's a lot to it. As I said, there's certainly a lot about the Koch brothers, and then it goes into the whole Wisconsin Scott Walker labor union protests and the fight to recall Scott Walker is kind of the framework of the film. But then there's, I love the Buddy Romer piece. I mean, so a lot of us don't know about Buddy Romer because he wasn't, I mean, we know who Buddy Romer is, maybe. We didn't know that he really did run for president and was shut out of all of the debates and wasn't allowed. And he's just an
incredible candidate. He was a governor
of
the state of Louisiana. He was a many-term congressman. He was Republican. And he had serious chops, you know, to be in the race.
Mm-hmm.
We loved him because he always made us laugh.
Mm-hmm.
He's very charming. And he was quite serious about keeping money out of his race.
Mm-hmm.
So he limited all donations to $100 or less.
Mm-hmm.
And you know where that got him.
Right. I mean, I think that if you took a poll in that theater afterwards, there would have been a lot of hands that would have given him some money, given him $100 at this point. He was fascinating. That was a really nice piece.
We thought it was also important just to show what it would look like. This is somebody who actually tried to go up against that tide of money,
mm-hmm.
and for a lot of reasons he couldn't survive, but always came down to the money.
Of course. Yeah. So then you also show the other part that I thought was so interesting was that you show these individual people who are nice, down to earth Midwesterners who have grown up as Republicans. And this was the first time with the Scott Walker recall was the first time they kind of really started to question their party and start to realize that maybe the Republicans weren't necessarily looking out for the hardworking Americans who they claim are their base, right?
That's right. Well, these are public employees. These are state employees. They a prison guard, a nurse,
mm-hmm.
A teacher. They work hard. They care for their families. They were willing to give concessions. All their unions were offering concessions to the governor,
mm-hmm.
But they weren't willing to give up their union rights. And when Governor Walker threatened them in that way,
mm-hmm.
they were aghast. That hadn't been part of his campaign platform. He hadn't shared that with, you know, the community at large. And so they had voted for him, and they felt absolutely betrayed.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to decide what to do next,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of them do participate really actively in the recall.
Mm-hmm. And how did you find those people? You just trekked on out. What, can you talk a little bit about going out to Wisconsin and how that got started?
Well, we were at the State House, you know, while Tahrir Square was exploding in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in Wisconsin, people were taking inspiration from that, and the State House filled up like that.
I forgot that was the same exact period. Yeah, same week.
Time. The State House in Wisconsin filled up with 100,000 people, you know, over the course of a week, and sometimes en masse, 100,000 would come out for a weekend protest. And one thing we noticed, a lot of them were Republicans. And you saw a lot of signs. We talked to a lot of people who had voted for Walker. The polls said 50% of Republicans were dissatisfied
mm-hmm.
with Scott Walker's aggressive right-wing agenda,
mm-hmm.
Anti-labor agenda. So, you know, the deeper we got into the story, we found out that Wisconsin, a town called Ripon, is home to the Republican Party. In 1854... a group of renegade Whigs who were anti-slavery, who lived in a commune, they lived communally, they worked communally, they owned a company together, and they set up this idealistic party that was all about free land, free men,
and that was
free soil.
That was 1854.
I believe it was 1854.
Yeah.
Huh.
No, and I mean, they were idealists. They might even say they were close to socialists.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, they formed the Republican Party, and they still proudly in Ripon proclaimed that
mm-hmm.
that's where it happened, the little white schoolhouse. So we went there out of curiosity, and I think we found a couple of our characters who welcomed us into their homes and let us follow them with a camera and helped us make sense
mm-hmm.
of what we were seeing out there.
Mm-hmm. And just exposed a lot of contradictions that are part of their, I don't know, part of what they're struggling with right now, which I thought that's really
interesting. Well, I mean, these are guys that they plow the roads, they teach the kids,
mm-hmm.
They're care for the elderly, you know,
mm-hmm.
the VA homes. I mean, these are guys, they work their bones off, and all of a sudden they were vilified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the same time that the wealthiest, you know, like the Kochs, are being exalted
right.
by folks like Mitt Romney, you know, these public employees are being vilified, and it was a topsy-turvy world for them, and we document some of that.
And you document the struggle well, because you can see them really, like the one Mary Jo, the librarian, right? She's really conflicted and figuring out.
Yeah. Her party is being taken over by extremists.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's stunned by that.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the Republican Party she was born and raised into.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a crisis of conscience. And
what do you hope audiences take away from your film? Do you mean it to be a call to action, or what is your goal? Do you have one?
I look, every filmmaker wants an audience to be swept away by the story, and this is a story. I mean,
mm-hmm.
this is not a polemic. This is a, you know, we take you into the heartland. We take you on the campaign trail with Betty Romer. We also take you into the Supreme Court chamber and help break down how Citizens United went down.
Because
mm-hmm. so many of us have heard, you know, the slogans, but we just don't.
That was really helpful to me, I have to say, because it really broke it down. Because you can read the papers day to day, but not see the, as I said, the big picture kind of. So,
you know, so really, I mean, look, we hope that people are taken in on this journey and think maybe differently,
mm-hmm.
engage in conversation about what they've seen, like it or hate it. You know, we just hope that we can talk about this, about, you know, our citizenship, about democracy, about how corporate interests are playing such a heavy role in our electoral system, and what can we do about it? We've got a website, citizencoke.com,
mm-hmm.
And we have resources on that website. We have partnerships with organizations. It's completely bipartisan. This is not Republicans versus Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is about the wealthiest interests having a bigger voice.
Mm-hmm.
Having a bigger voice than working people, working families, middle class.
Yeah.
Are you hopeful?
It's totally transpartisan. And in July, there was a poll where 87% of all Americans said that they thought that campaign finance reform, money and politics
mm-hmm.
should be a top priority in the next administration. So, you know, one thing that we hope people will take out of this is to understand that the implications of a decision like Citizens United and the cultural shift in our political cultural shift where wealthiest people are exalted, as Tia said, and corporations are given
the rights of people,
free speech,
right.
and
mm-hmm.
spend money however they want in the political system, has an impact in their communities, not just on who's president, who isn't president. That money is deployed at the state level, also in secret, without disclosure rules, and it all flows from the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Citizens.
So it was a real reminder about how crucial that those Supreme Court nominations are. And
We hope. We just don't want people to feel a sense of complacency.
Right.
You know, if you're a Democrat and you're happy that Obama won, that does not mean that Citizens United is not having an impact in our body politic, in our elections. Because
mm-hmm.
it is.
Look, it's no big revelation that money, you know, has
power,
that sway
right.
over our politicians. That's age old, right? I think what was a revelation was for us was in part, you know, the attacks on organized labor aren't just attacks about, you know, what people earn for a living and capitalists wanting to have more capital, but in fact, it seems like a concerted strategy to defund the Democratic Party
mm-hmm.
because organized labor is among the biggest contributors to the Democratic Party. For whatever reason, they don't get much out of it. But,
right.
They, you know, I think, you know, and we just saw Right to Work passed these laws crippling
mm-hmm.
public and private employee unions in Michigan, in the birthplace of the UAW.
Mm-hmm.
Courtesy of
Americans for Prosperity, which is bankrolled lock, stock, and barrel by Charles and David Koch, the fourth and fifth wealthiest men in America.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
they don't admit to who's funding them. This is an organization that has a $40 million a year budget. What are they doing? They're attacking our rights on the state level, on all sorts of levels.
Mm. What did you do when Glenn Beck, did he go off the air?
Glenn Beck went off the air.
So now have you found something else to fill your time?
The Good Wife.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's
right.
We're happy with that.
Yeah, I've had enough of Glenn Beck now. And America apparently has too.
You're right? Exactly.
But it was a nice curiosity for a while.
That's
while
funny.
It lasted.
So tell me a little bit about your return to Sundance. Have you had a good time this week? We're just kind of wrapping up here.
Oh, it's such a thrill to be here. You know, we love this place.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Mertford has created this environment for independent filmmakers. It's like no other. Some of the best audiences out there come here to see our films. And we have a lot of Brooklynites, actually, too, filmmakers who converge, and you get to see
there do seem to be
films.
A lot, yeah.
But, no, it's such a supportive community.
Mm-hmm.
We make our work in isolation. We scrap for money. We're under-resourced. So it's really a treat and a privilege to come to a place like this and have our work seen and launched. We feel a little spoiled.
Well, congratulations to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us here on FilmWax Radio, and we'll see you back in Brooklyn.
This is Adam Shartoff, host of FilmWax Radio, the independent film talk show, Wednesday nights, 6:30 to 7:30 on BeBoxRadio.com.